This week on The Droids, we talk about studio leaks and all that comes from when news about films and parts of the story leaks out ahead of time, as well as comments from Rian Johnson on The Rise of Skywalker, the Cassian Andor series, Kelly Marie Tran at the Oscars, and we tease out something special that's coming up on the pod. All that and so much more this week on The Droids. Welcome back to The Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Alongside Rian and Sam, I am Mike. And guys, what a moment to celebrate The Rise of Skywalker this weekend at the Oscars, winning the Visual Effects Award, a much-deserved Oscar. Oh, wait. It went to 1917. Can someone explain that to me?
Oh, that was the one shot movie that was all a single take and done in camera.
Oh, I saw the film. I'm saying, why did it win?
Oh, I see what you're asking.
Well, maybe we'll ask Chris. He's not here with us today because he the last time we saw him, he was headed to the Vanity Fair party, and we haven't seen him since.
was he flying out there in his private jet?
Yeah, he was flying out on his private jet. We've seen him in the background of several famous people's Instagrams, but we can't find him ourselves.
Was he the one delivering water this time around? Is that why he was in the background?
Yeah, the last time we saw him, he was in the background of an Instagram giving Chrissy Teigen a bottle of water.
To all our listeners out there, if you've seen Chris, please send him our way. Send him home. There's a healthy reward of pizza and gratitude.
Unlike previous podcasts, we do know that Chris is still full of life functions. He has not had those ceased yet. So at least he's out there, and we want him back.
As far
so
as
know.
We know.
Oh boy,
he's with the truth on the
X-Files. So this week on the pod, we've got much to discuss, as it seems like there's been little bits of news kind of leaking out, and let's just kind of get into a bit of it, some of the little tidbits that we heard over this weekend during the Oscars, news about Rian Johnson, news about the Cassian Andor series. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, Droids Pod on Twitter and Instagram, The Droids Podcast on Facebook, rate and review us on iTunes. If you rate and review us on iTunes, we promise to send something special your way. Droid sticker, yes. Well, I know we still owe one of those droid stickers to one of you out there. So if you're listening, I know you are. We'll get it to you eventually. It's been a busy season, so I promise the sticker's on its way. But we'll get you a sticker. We will potentially mention you as one of the honorary droids if you give us a rate and review on iTunes. That's a pretty
hell, maybe we'll even
offer.
Give you the podcast. Maybe the podcast will be yours then. This is not binding.
And also, don't forget to email us droidspod@gmail.com.
Also, based on the framing, there's a good chance that picture of Adam Driver and Rian Johnson at the Netflix Oscar party was taken by Chris.
Yeah,
there's
very,
no way to say that it wasn't.
Very
true.
Very, very low to the ground.
Oh boy!
Sam. It looked like it was about, you know, the fourth try. he wanted to play around with a new app that he had installed.
If you haven't seen that picture,
it had one of those iPhone lens dongles. Clearly,
and you can see the outline of a finger right in the corner.
If you have not seen that picture, it is on the Droids Pod Twitter account. It is, you know, Adam Driver, there's only one thing you can say about it. He is beaming to be sitting next to Rian Johnson, and it's presented a lot of speculation. Now, this is our Star Wars podcast. We will be talking about Star Wars, obviously, throughout this episode. We do it every week. But we do want to mention that Rian Johnson has Knives Out 2 on the way. He's got the sequel. And once that photo was out there, the thought was, could this be a reunion of sorts? Adam Driver, back with Rian Johnson, in a Benoit Blanc film.
First off, that would be
unquestionably
delightful, of course. That would be delightful. To me, the bigger story is that a few weeks ago when Adam Driver hosted SNL, there were pictures of him and Rian Johnson at the SNL after party. Oh. After Rian Johnson, I followed his entire evening, after Rian Johnson had gone with Noah Segan, also a star of Knives Out, to go see Billy Joel at his residency in Madison Square Garden. I have to mention Billy Joel at least once a year on the podcast, as he is the patron saint of Long Island, and he is still with us. And when he is not, I will have to go sit Shiva for 7 days. But he went to see Billy Joel, and he went to the after party, the SNL after party, with assumedly at the invite of one Mr. Adam Driver. And then they're sitting together at the Oscar party. So even if they're not going to work together in the near future, it warms my heart that they clearly enjoyed each other very much. And that Adam Driver probably knows that The Last Jedi was the best Star Wars movie in years.
Well, and you saw who he
and
went
that's
to.
That's the bottom line.
And you saw who he went to that Baijiu concert with.
Noah Segan.
And?
Oh, was there another? Josh
Danny
Gad?
Danny Boy.
Like
my
Danny
Mr. Bond.
Craig.
Mr. Bond
Daniel
James Bond.
Craig. Daniel Craig was at the Billy Joel concert?
It's wild but true, yes. Isn't that insane?
My God.
So,
you know who
clearly
else was probably there? I'm going to say Mike Piazza, Keith Hernandez. All of
you. When you look at, like, just in, while we're on this Rian Johnson knives talk, talking knives, the sharpest pod in the drawer.
Well, talking knives, if Knives becomes a TV series at some point, that will be our after show special, Talking Knives, right?
Yeah. That'll be our Chris Hardwick. That'll be our Chris Hardwick-esque talking show, minus the creepy allegations.
Clearly,
oh,
you know,
no one wants to talk about Hardwick.
No, I just didn't say anything because you stole my joke.
Looks like I'm not going to be invited on ID10T anytime soon.
When you look at, like, Rian Johnson clearly likes to work with people he knows. He works with people over and over again. You know, most notably, obviously, Ron Bergman's produced all his films. Joseph Gordon-Levitt's been in a number of his films. It's like a cousin and maybe a brother who, like, score and do sound on
his,
a lot
yeah,
of his movies.
Yeah, his cousin does it. Nathan Johnson, I believe.
Yep.
And when you look at, like, the actors he's worked with, like, regularly, you've got, or, like, just regularly and or recently, there's such a deep pool for Knives, like, a Knives Out sequel. It's, you know, Adam Driver, I mentioned Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's worked with Mark Ruffalo, Adrian Brody, Laura Dern, Andy Serkis, Bruce Willis, Jeff Daniels, Emily Blunt, obviously, Kelly Marie Tran. And then there's, like, all the people that Daniel Craig has worked with over the years on the Bond films, which has had, like, you know, its own laundry list of talent. It's these movies, just like the first one, I anticipate if they continue making them, they will always be these, like, stacked ensembles with, you know, crazy A-list talent just as kids in candy stores, like, making up wild characters. Oh, Benicio
speaking
del Toro.
Of,
get that guy in there.
Oh, my God. Speaking of Daniel Craig collaborators that I would love to see in a Knives Out sequel, Jeffrey Wright. He'd fit so well in that world.
Absolutely.
The way you're describing
Knives cast.
The way you're describing the cast, though, it sounds quite familiar to a trailer we just saw today from Wes Anderson. Stacked cast. I think we might not necessarily say that Rian Johnson is following that lead, but he could be the same kind of director who gets whatever actor he wants in a huge ensemble with maybe small parts for some of them because people love to work with him.
I'm hoping that they break some universe rules, and when Rian Johnson hopefully returns to a galaxy far, far away, maybe, you know, in an act of very confusing world building, Adam Driver plays grown-up Broom Kid.
I thought you were going to go for there is a case to be made for Benoit Blanc to turn up in the Star Wars universe.
I'd like that, too. That business down on Cata Pneumonia doesn't count.
I thought you were going in a different direction. You were going to reference the
in
dagger.
In the tip-yip is an even smaller tip-yip. And that tip-yip has its own tip-yip.
I thought you were going to reference the dagger from Rise of Skywalker as a knife that becomes the Knives Out in the Star Wars universe going forward.
Yeah, it's but I don't even there. Know what to call that thing. What is it going to be, Wayfinders Out?
Well, continuing on our Rian Johnson conversation as we keep this pod moving along, Rian Johnson was interviewed on the red carpet of the Oscars. He did have original screenplay, was nominated from Knives Out for Best Original Screenplay. He did not win. sadly, but I think we all kind of knew that that was going to be a long shot for him. I was interested to hear what he said. He came out and his reaction was, "I had a blast, man. Made me so proud, and seeing the heart and soul that JJ put into it and seeing my friends who were in the movie just like bring the whole thing to a conclusion. Yeah, for me as a Star Wars fan, it was a really special experience." Rian Johnson is always a wonderful, polite person, and I'm
he's
not going to put...
He's so classy.
He is, and I'm not going to put any words in his mouth because I have no idea what he really thought of the movie. That's really a statement of, I'm going to just be pretty across the board. It was a good movie, and that's about it. He didn't say anything more. I wouldn't expect him to. He knows how to act. He knows how to treat other collaborators, unlike some of the people who made The Rise of Skywalker when they were talking about him in the press tour.
Yeah, no, if I were Rian Johnson, I'm not sure I'd be as gracious.
Mike, you guys need to read the next paragraph, because they asked him where he saw it, and he said, "Oh, I just saw it at my local theater. But when I was walking in, one of the popcorn machines fell directly on my head on the way in." So, you know, that's the no shade, but you know, who knows what he saw.
He was rocking a head wound.
I'm glad he's doing okay. A little woozy, got some butter in there.
he was bleeding from the ear when he gave that answer.
The guy's endlessly classy, endlessly tactful. And you know, he gave a nice statement without really saying anything about the quality of the movie.
Because really, what he said was like, "I loved it. My friends were in it."
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But that's who I thought were my friends.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, true. I'm not going to take that though as him insulting the movie by the fact that he was so, you know, just kind of straightforward with it. I feel like that's just exactly what a professional person would do. So we don't know what he really thought of the movie, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he hated it. And I'm not saying either one of you are saying that, but I feel like that's part of the reaction that we're currently seeing is, oh, Rian Johnson had a pretty practiced response. He must have hated the movie. I don't know that I would say that.
No, the greatest version of this for me would be that, hey, Rian Johnson actually had a good time and kind of liked it and didn't feel slighted or wronged or, you know, like it was a setback or a disappointment in any way. That's the dream. I want it for him. I find it, you know, difficult to believe that that would be the case, because I think he's a person who likes good movies, but like... he's a delight. He's a delight through and through. He's, you know, shown nothing but like love. And also, if you consider that, you know, he is at present, you know, presumably, you know, still working on a series of films in this galaxy with this studio, it's like, what's he going to say? You know, it's, you know, you don't bite the hand that feeds you or the one that's handing you potentially, you know, keys to one of the most fun kingdoms you can play in.
Also, I feel like I don't know him, but for all intents and purposes, he seems like a lovely person. It's very possible that he was like, why would I want to say something bad about someone else's movie?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he knows how hard it is to make a movie. He's off doing his thing. Also, he wore poor cufflinks to the Oscars.
I was just about to bring it up.
Oh, I'm sorry,
love it.
Mike.
No, I'm glad you did, because I love that he did that, because it also felt like he's still in this world. He still cares so much about it. He's not trying to distance himself, which makes me hopeful they'll make those films. I don't know that they will. But other thing about it is watching that and thinking that Porgs, the way we initially reacted to them, I don't remember us across the board talking about it, but I felt like... my thought was, oh, they might lean a little too heavy on this. Oh, this is one of those merchandising opportunities that they can really get kids with. Watching The Rise of Skywalker, I just have nothing but absolute adoration for the Porgs. I love them.
Yeah.
And
me
I'm
too.
So happy that we saw them. I want the cufflinks. I'm going to get cufflinks myself.
I'm Porg neutral. Like, I genuinely don't actually think they, like for me, you know, trying to be as objective as I can, I don't think they add much to the movie for me. They do have some moments of humor, but what I like about them is that it was, I love the film aspect of it, that it was a solution to a problem. You know, I love that it was
a puffin problem.
Yeah, I love that it was a genuine, like, there was a challenge on set, and in George, you know, in Lucasian you know, manner, he tackled it through like clever design and like smart filmmaking solutions where it's like, hey, we don't need to paint these all out. We don't need to do anything. What we can do is leave them all in the shots and then create an in-world reason that there would be, you know, something fun, very Star Warsian on the set. And so from that regard, like, that's part of what I love about the Porgs and the fact that, like, the Porgs have, in a larger context, in a larger conversation, become emblematic and representative of Rian Johnson and The Last Jedi. And so it's like, I stan that movie, I stan that guy, so, like, yeah, of course I love Porgs. But, like,
well, it's
story-wise,
it's reminiscent,
meh.
Yeah. It's reminiscent of the story about how when they were shooting Norway for Hoth on The Empire Strikes Back,
they got there,
and there were a bunch of goats hanging around, which is weird because goats aren't indigenous to that area. And they were like, how are we going to shoot around this? I guess we'll have them ride something. And that's where Tauntauns came from.
The production,
Goatgate.
Production
Goatgate
design was 80, able to 80, do that.
Goatgate 1980 caused the Tauntauns.
Very easy to update stop motion based on what you see on set when you're shooting.
Yeah. They still don't know where the goats came from or where they went.
Other things from the Oscars. Kelly Marie Tran, she had an introduction. I don't remember who she introduced, actually.
Questlove.
Was it? Well, no. She was sitting next to Questlove. She didn't introduce Questlove.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Because she was just kind of excited about the fact that she was next to Questlove, which was awesome.
Who wouldn't be? Yeah.
But that moment, it felt like, what a contrast from her on the red carpet of The Rise of Skywalker, which was stone cold expression, a lot more seriousness in her reactions versus having a delightful time at the Oscars. And she was seated behind a number of nominees, and you just saw her laughing it up, having a great time, and then singing along to the absolutely outrageously nonsensical performance of Eminem being at the Oscars. But she knew everything, and she was quite into it. And then I saw her on the red carpet, and she seemed to be having fun again. And it just felt like, oh, some of this burden has been lifted. Now, she did say, she came out with a statement that she didn't have an issue. She felt so proud to be a part of Star Wars and so lucky to be a part of it that she didn't have an issue with her role in The Rise of Skywalker. Again, statement that may have been a bit rehearsed. However, I'm just happy to see her back out there being her joyful self.
Yeah, and again, totally. class act.
Yeah, Mike, she's I'm just going to jump in. I don't think you were saying this. I don't think this is like what you intended, but just like, just to clarify in terms of like when you're saying, oh, she, you know, on the red carpet, you know, very stone cold and stoic and everything. Yeah. I don't think there was like, in my reading, you know, I don't think there was an iciness. I don't think there was like a stone coldness so much as like, I got a vibe, like at every red carpet for Rise of Skywalker, Kelly Marie Tran looked like $100 million. And I got a very distinct sense of like, this was a little bit of like flexing on your exes, you know, of like going on where it's like, okay, they really kind of tanked my character. They didn't write me a lot. I've done the whole marketing game. I'm going to walk out and like absolutely just like drop everybody's jaws with like an amazing dress, tons of confidence. I'm going to go out and like kind of defy expectations as the person who was, you know, comedic relief and, you know, like not someone who is thought of as like instantly like a glamorous, you know, like ingenue starlet, right? Like I got the impression there was a little of that going on, but that also it's like there was also just the chance of like, well, she did the red carpets for The Last Jedi and had a genuinely amazing experience, you know, up until the internet like treated her like garbage. And then this was kind of a chance of like, hey, how many times am I going to do a Star Wars red carpet for, you know, a saga movie? Precisely one more time. So let's do it and own it.
No, it's, and Sam, I'm glad that you jumped in, because that's, I didn't mean it that, I didn't mean it.
I knew you didn't, and I wasn't, yeah, I wasn't trying to put that in, but I don't want anyone to miss, like, mishear that or like misunderstand sort of what we're saying in terms of like, there was definitely just sort of emotionally and tonally, it did feel like, oh man, we're seeing that Kelly Marie Tran that like we all met and like instantly fell in love with in whatever it was, 2016 or 15, whenever her casting was announced. And Rian Johnson, you know, kind of launched her for better or worse, and I think better, you know, into this like new stratosphere of like acting and stardom and this whole journey. But like, you know, she owns it, and yeah, I'm delighted that she was having a ball at the Oscars, because, you know, probably 5 years ago she didn't expect to be there, and, you know, and so that's great.
And by no means, she should do any whatever she wants at any red carpet. I was just enjoying the way she was acting at the Oscars, and honestly, I was thinking of it when she showed up at The Rise of Skywalker. I felt like it was just like, I'm gonna have this expression of F you to the people who cut me out of this movie. And I know that's not the way she really could act, but that's how I was reading it, and kind of being like, yes, please act that way towards these people who created this and made you a minute 30 of screen time.
Once again, the fan surrogate for a Star Wars experience.
Yes, yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So from there, let's talk a little bit about, I think we were talking about Lucasian, whatever you said before, Sam. The Cassian Andor series is coming up. Diego Luna said it'll be filming at the end of this year. There were rumors that Mr. George Lucas might be returning to pen and lead that series. Those rumors were possibly from who knows where of a Reddit subthread, but they were out there. And
we're
what
not
did you
call
think
them
when
credible,
you
but they're certainly rumors.
They're certainly things that people have said about something.
If it's true, I'm thrilled. Truly, like I think it's dope as hell. You know, it's it's possible that they may wrap in some of the stuff that they were working on for Star Wars Underground, because there were so many scripts written for that potential show that didn't happen. But this idea of George being involved again, I think, is incredibly exciting. I hope it's true.
I'd love to see it. I couldn't imagine it actually happening. I really couldn't.
Yeah, it seems unbelievable, but you know.
Yeah, I think I like what you're saying, Ryan. I guess like I think we're all on the same page, and I guess I would just couch it as like there's two different responses, right? And it's like, do I want to see George Lucas come back and, you know, write and produce and even direct on, or like steer, you know, show run a Star Wars series on Disney Plus, like now in 2020 or the next few years? Absolutely. That would be so dope. It would be absolutely incredible to like see him back in his world, in the world he created. If it were, it, you know, would he, if it were for the Cassian Andor series, all the better. So cool. What a great character. What an interesting time period. This is so far like from being based in any reality we live in. It's like, okay. Like that was, I can say anything too, you know? I mean, this was, you know, this is like when, you know, with the, what was it called? Star Wars Underground. What was the series?
Yeah, Star Wars Underground.
I mean, you know, that to me, like we had an offline, I know you guys talked about it, but we had an offline conversation as well, where it was like, looking at that footage, I mean, yeah, it's dated now, and yeah, it's following on the heels, like playing in the sort of effects sandbox that was developed for the prequels. So, you know, maybe it doesn't look quite as crisp and sharp and cool as The Mandalorian, but like, oh, am I on board for that series? If I could snap my fingers and have it, hell yes, I would love that. I would watch every episode, and I'd probably like really love it. And it's not just, you know, I don't think it's just like a blind fandom of you know, George, the cult of George, but it's like the one thing he was always doing was like pushing to show something that we hadn't seen before, and that's the element that would be exciting to me if he were to do something.
You know, it's a crazy thing to think of to me that if he came back, he would come back to focus on a show that was about a character he didn't create. I mean, I know he created the entire world, but to focus on something that was not his storytelling, when you could have him jump back into any other part of the saga or
in a
around
time,
the saga, yeah.
In a time period that he already did what he wanted with, right? Like, yeah. He told the prequels up to the point that he wanted to take them. Right, like there was no reason he couldn't have gone on to show how, you know, the Empire actually rose out of the ashes of the Republic. He didn't, what we saw was the fall of Anakin Skywalker, and he stopped there. And so the idea that he would come back for a series that takes place in between his two trilogies, I'm like, nah. he's doing something that takes place at this point. He would do something that takes place after 9 or like, honestly, almost I'd be like, he's going to do it before the galaxy formed and he's going to do it in a different galaxy.
Yeah. You know, I actually, that's more accurate to me, or some other layer of the galaxy, layer of like our own existence or perception of existence. More likely, I mean, Broom Boy. He would do the Broom Boy series. You know, that's the another logical step. But I want to say, if we anybody can say anything and create a rumor, I think we have new episode of the show where it's just rumor central and we come up with different ideas. Chris not being on this episode right now to give us some sort of unfounded rumor that could spread like wildfire throughout the internet, I'm disappointed we don't have that right now, because I think Chris would have a hot and fresh for us that would really take everyone by storm.
We'll get Chris on. We'll do an outpost soon, and it'll be, we'll present it. All right, so anybody listening to this episode, you're in on the secret. You know what's going to happen, which is that sometime soon, there's going to be an episode of The Outpost where we report straight up lies as fact. And we're not going to address it. We're not going to acknowledge that it's all made up. But we're all going to come and we're going to bring our A game, and we're going to create some seriously juicy internet rumors. And the only way you're going to know is you're going to have to go back and listen to past episodes to find out we telegraphed it and told you they were all made up.
You know what I heard from a Lucasfilm source? They're going to do a de-age version of Harrison Ford, redo Solo, where it's a deep fake and a creation of Harrison Ford doing the role again in 8 episodes. It's happening. See, that's an example. That's what you can expect in the upcoming episodes.
I mean, that sounds great.
Well, as we continue on with our pod, let's talk a little bit more. We've addressed this already, the Colin Trevorrow, Derek Connolly script for Duel of Fates that could have been episode 9. We talked about our initial reactions to what was almost a plot synopsis. That script has been going around corners of the internet. It has found its way to us here at the pod. We will do an episode where
allegedly.
It's allegedly. I'm not
there
sure.
There has been an awakening.
That doesn't sound like the thing you want it to
the
sound
dead
like.
Speak. The dead speak. No,
that's more accurate.
But I think what we will do is we will talk more in depth about that as we all get through. We'll have an episode that's strictly about those story points and what we took away from it. But we want to kind of talk a little bit more now that a couple of us have gotten into this script. We mentioned some of what really stood out. Obviously, at the crawl at the beginning, it sets up an entirely different track for the film, which I really love the idea of Kylo trying to snuff out communication within the galaxy. And I know that both Sam, you, and Ryan have gone a little bit further into this script, but before we get to a full breakdown, what have you taken away from what you've been able to read?
It's from what I've read, it's very good. It's not perfect. It's the draft that I have allegedly read is dated December 16th, 2016. So that's before the release, right? That's before The Last Jedi was even released.
And it's shortly after Carrie Fisher passed away, right?
Right. So it's a year before The Last Jedi was even released. So I imagine if they had continued on this path, there would have been some adjustments in terms of, Last Jedi things, or because The Last Jedi wasn't done yet. But to me, it continues on many of the threads of The Last Jedi. It advances a lot of the plots, does very interesting things. There are elements of it that I'm not like a huge fan of, just where I'm like, that's not the decision I would make. But even those things are done pretty well. So it's like, in a world where they were probably going to have another year to kind of get this script tighter and like do it, this seemed like this is a great place for it to be.
Like, I think if you've if you're someone who's read if you've read screenplays, if you've read treatments of things at various stages, and I mean, we live in an era where you can go on the internet and you can find any script of any movie at almost any stage of development for going back to a lot of great films, and with that in mind, the fact that this was the draft of the script that they had 3 years out from this movie's release, and in its state, there are moments of, even in this version of this draft of the script, there are moments of dialogue that are truly, like, I mean, they're better than anything in Rise of Skywalker. They're funny, or they're poignant, and this thing was pretty far along, and it's, you know, to me, again, I'd echo what Ryan says. It's not a perfect script. I wouldn't expect it to be in 2016, you know, but in terms of like where this was story-wise, it 100% is picking up on the threads of The Last Jedi. It's also tying it, it's a more complete arc from The Force Awakens to Last Jedi to Duel of the Fates that actually adds kind of a satisfying direction for all of the characters. We see some characters we really liked get utilized better.
Oh yeah.
yes. in some meaningful ways. And the other big takeaway I have, I have not reached the very end. I'm probably like 70 or 80% through it. And I'm going to finish it tonight, obviously, because then we'll, as Mike mentioned, do a really deep dive and go through kind of like beat by beat. But it's dark. And I think it's like, in a way, welcomingly dark. I don't think it's irretrievably dark, but like, I don't think any Star Wars movie has kind of hit this tone of like, kind of, desperation and hopelessness for the rebellion, with perhaps the exception of Rogue One, played a little bit in that world. And man, to take your 9 film capper and put it in that place where there was so much greater of a sense of urgency. Just I would say even in the first 5 pages of this screenplay, in terms of like it opens feeling like the First Order is gonna win, and it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. Like, that's where this movie starts you and has you feeling like, I don't see how our heroes can overcome all the ground that Supreme Leader Kylo Ren and Chancellor Hux, which is what Hux is called in this version, which is so much doper.
There were two things.
No, it starts in that place already feels so much more right for what they were billing this movie to be. I'm sorry, I went on pretty long. So were you going to chime in?
There were two things that really struck me about it. The first is that it has a genuine sense of escalation in terms of the trilogy that it would have been a part of, which is like, we talk about, you know, the third movie, third movies and trilogies always has this tough thing where the second tends to be the best one, because the third one, it kind of needs to escalate everything and then come to a conclusion, which can be satisfying or not. But this one, I found that it had a genuine sense of escalation in terms of the stakes getting higher, but not ridiculously high, where it's just like, and now they have a fleet that could destroy everything forever, always, never stopped.
So yeah, it's not meaningless. Yeah,
there's a genuine sense of emotional and like plot escalation. And the other thing is that after the Last Jedi continued, you know, moments after Force Awakens ended, which I thought was kind of a brilliant choice. We had never seen that before. This one, having to do this escalation, has a genuine feeling of time gone by, where they have the same way between Empire and Jedi, you know, Luke comes back and is very changed. They have a lot of elements where characters have genuinely changed in the time between. Like, this isn't a spoiler or anything, but one of the notable things is that Hux, they note that he has, like, gray hairs now. And it's like, I thought that was just a really brilliant kind of choice to just throw that in, which is like, yeah, this has taken a toll on everybody. And
well, there's only so many times you can be thrown against the wall of an AT-AT without your hair going gray.
Yeah. And there are things that they do to tie in the original trilogy. There is again, this is a very light spoiler. There is an Emperor moment in it, but the Emperor is not heavily featured, and I thought that was a perfect way to do it. You know, like, they tie in this sense of lineage and past things without it impeding on the progression of the characters that we know.
When you hit on that sense of time passage, Ryan, for all the characters, I think this was a thing that it really rang false to me, and it really rang as like marketing speak or like PR spin when The Rise of Skywalker came out. They made a lot. They made hay of that. They kept saying, oh, it's a year later and like the characters have all grown and you're going to see how they, you know, operate together and everything. And a big deal was made of seeing, you know, the big three supposedly together. And we've talked at length on the pod about how that didn't quite bear fruit in the movie. You know, firstly, the supposed passage of time really didn't feel like it had passed. The characters didn't feel like they'd changed, and certainly not changed to move forward. If anything, they'd regressed, some of them. And then this idea of like the way that growth would affect the team dynamic, and seeing them together. And what's wild to me is that this screenplay exhibits that to me better than the movie that was made. Now, I think it's also worth noting, like, this, just to frame this whole discussion, like, because we're obviously coming on, like, Ryan and I, with what we've read, are very impressed and, you know, definitely coming out, like, in sort of support of this vision of the movie. And, I mean, we do have to note, like, there would have needed to be a lot of changes, you know, based on
Leia
real life events.
Featured heavily, yes.
The script would have needed to change. The script would have changed independent of need. This thing never got to shoot. There are things in the script that, you know, we don't know what this movie was, so we cannot fairly, you know, compare it side by side to The Rise of Skywalker. But what I think we can kind of investigate is, like, it's nice to have a view of what the direction they were initially going to take this film in. Like, we get that view, and that can be a salve on our wounds for those of us disappointed in Rise of Skywalker. But also, I think it really sort of pulls into sharp focus the type of filmmakers we had on Rise of Skywalker, in that, like, the idea that the team assembled, the fact that this story that had been being developed was totally thrown out, I think speaks kind of volumes, and especially when compared to, like, what they came up with to replace it. You know, it speaks to me about where their priorities were and, like, how they approach filmmaking and storytelling and art making, in a way that, like, really disappoints me. But I, you know, you can also go back and put some of this has to be put on Trevorrow, because, you know, ultimately the creative differences, whether he was fired or walked or whatever, it was like something happened that put him at an impasse with Disney. You know,
you bring me to the one question that I have. I have many, many questions about this, having not read it yet, and I'm very excited to talk about all of it when I've had a chance and Chris have had a chance, that we've all read it and we can come back and have all of us talk about this entire script. But the one question I have for the two of you, from what you've read so far, is there anything in it that made you be like, oh, okay, maybe this is why they decided they wanted to go a different direction? Like, this is the thing that made Bob Iger and Kathleen Kennedy say, you know what, Trevorrow's is not working out? Or do you think it had nothing to do with the script and it was entirely that they were concerned about him being a still relatively green blockbuster filmmaker? I mean, I know he had made Jurassic World, but I just mean, like, he's not of J.J.'s caliber at that time.
So I can't remember if he departed before or after The Last Jedi came out. So, but in terms of them not deciding to go with this script or concept, to me, it's directly based on what they perceived as a reaction to The Last Jedi.
Yeah,
because there's nothing in this script that I'm like, you know, aside from the death of Carrie Fisher, which certainly there would have to be adjustments. There's nothing in this script that I'm like, wow, this is so wild. I can't even see how they could get on the same page with this.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with Ryan that. So to directly answer, like, Mike, yeah, I haven't encountered anything yet either like that. Again, I have a little ways to go, but I mean, I think there's a lot of moving pieces, right? And I think there was a little bit of a perfect storm to get this movie thrown in the bin, which is that you have The Last Jedi release as a you know, pretty uncompromising execution of Rian Johnson's story and vision, doing what he wanted with the characters, how he wanted. You have, you know, there's some like, you know, hearsay evidence that, you know, that Trevorrow, you know, had wanted a few different pieces left on the table or a few different things to happen, you know, and that he was trying to pressure Disney and or Rian Johnson in terms of like setting up the film he wanted to make. So there's potential for like some, you know, some conflict there. You've got, you know, this person, Colin Trevorrow, who's made at the time, you know, like the first of this like new era of like mega blockbusters of like huge nostalgia bombs that do like crazy business. And so he has a lot of clout and he has some power to dig in on the story he wants to tell. And then you have a backlash against The Last Jedi from a vocal part of the fan base that definitely reached the ear of some studio heads. You have the Book of Henry break its nose falling down the stairs at the box office and do horribly, which depowers Trevorrow in their eyes and takes away his ability to say, no, we want to do this. And you have the death of Carrie Fisher ahead of that, but this factor of like, we lost, you know, in some ways an anchor of this film. We've got problems with this franchise. We've got a director who's not as bankable, and panic ensues and things get thrown out. And then I think what I'm commenting on is like with who you bring in, then there's, I think, a lot of directors who would say, yeah, we're going to take that script. We're going to retool it. We're going to have more writers. This is going to be a movie that has five or six writers listed, but we're going to get the best story possible and finish this trilogy up. And then you have people who I think reading this screenplay in a draft form is further evidence of that there are filmmakers out there and writers out there who it's like they're interested in total ownership and authorial control over what they're making. And look, that's a director and producer and writer's right, you know, but I think it was to the detriment of episode 9 in this case.
So I think that is a great place for us to stop and kind of tease the setup of the conversation of where we're going to be with this when we revisit it and have all of us talk about the whole script. I can't
help. We can't talk about it fully until Chris has read it. So we'll see you in 2024.
when he's back from the Variety party.
The last time someone saw him, he was walking into Spago's.
But the last thing I want to say is that out of what you both have just said, it kind of just sparks in my mind what I think we've talked about numerous times about the way Disney sees this, is that they want to make broad blockbusters. They don't want anything divisive. And even though this, and having obviously not read it yet, isn't probably not as divisive as what The Last Jedi turned out to be, the continuation of what was divisive is what they probably wanted to stay away from. And it just feels like somebody in the studio said, no, make this broader. I want everyone to like it. We have to make it for everybody, because if we're not making it for everybody, we're not making the most money we could.
Yeah. I think so. And I think in terms of, I mean, just because I, you know, Mike, I know we're wrapping up. What I'd say is to our listeners out there, like, you know, Ryan and I think would both say like, hey, go find this and read it. It's interesting. It's an interesting artifact, if nothing else. And if you're listening to a Star Wars podcast, you're probably curious about it.
And Sam, you said this, it's kind of like a cool piece of EU.
It is very much at this point what I think the EU was for a lot of us for many years. You know,
it feels like an Elseworlds story or something.
This thing that now exists that can live in your mind. It can live right beside episode 9. It can replace episode 9. It can be your version of canon. And, you know, look, if we want to paint it in the best light, we all get to make this film in our brains. You know, we all get to picture it ourselves, which is a cool thing, especially given the fact that, like, for better or worse, fortunately or unfortunately, we're never going to see this thing shot. You know, in 20 or 30 years, Disney, somebody at Disney might dig through the script vault of material they have and say, hey, there's some good ideas here. I want to use this. So we might see bits and bobs of it turn up places, but like, this is how this movie exists. And so I would say if you are someone curious, I'd say go out and find it, read it, and join us back here for the full rundown. You know, if you can't find it, you know, email us at droidspod@gmail.com. You know, give us a review on iTunes, and you know, maybe we know about a wayfinder, maybe we know about a holocron that can get you where you're going, right? Allegedly.
I take it there's no wayfinders in the percentage of the script you guys have read so far.
No. A what?
There are no wayfinders.
Okay.
They use the correct name for a wayfinder.
Okay, thank you. Oh well, yeah. That's good to know. All right. I think that has been a very good way to set up that conversation. I think we'll have that in the next few weeks for you. This has been the Droid You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. We look forward to talking more about the greatest cinematic franchise in the history of the galaxy. What they throw?
James Bond.
Oh, what?
Colin?
No.
good time was had by all.